Upon assuming the presidency in 1953, Dwight Eisenhower came to be seen by many as a doddering lightweight. Yet behind the bland smile and apparent simple-mindedness was a brilliant intellectual tactician. As Evan Thomas reveals in Ike's Bluff, his examination of Ike's White House years, Eisenhower was a master of calculated duplicity. As with his bridge and poker games, he was eventually forced to stop playing after leaving too many fellow Army officers insolvent. Ike could be patient and ruthless in the con and generous and expedient in his partnerships. Facing the Soviet Union, China, and his own generals, some of whom believed a first strike was the only means of survival, Eisenhower would make his boldest and riskiest bet yet, one of such enormity that there could be but two outcomes, the survival of the world or its end. Thomas says this book, Ike's Bluff, is the story of how we won. Evan Thomas is the author of several best-selling works of history and biography. He teaches journalism at Princeton University, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Evan Thomas to the program. Thank you very much for being with us, sir.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure. Yeah, thanks for having me.
You're last on for The War Lovers, and it's great to have you back. This book is fascinating. I've recently become incredibly interested in Eisenhower. And this book came for me personally at a very good time because I was just starting to plunge into to read about this man. He really is a very complex, fascinating figure.
Well, he is. I mean, you know, as you were saying, there's this public image that has lasted for years that he was this genial, grandfatherly guy, played a lot of golf, not too bright maybe, you know, kind of a caretaker. And, of course, that's all wrong. He did play a lot of golf. That part is true. 800 times as president. And he could be genial. He did have a sunny smile. But there was another Ike. I was talking to his son, John, who I got to know during the course of this. And we were talking about the balance between the genial, sunny, friendly Ike and the more calculating, cold-blooded Eisenhower, 50-50. And John smiled and he said, well, make that 75% cold-blooded. And this is his own son. So, of course, you have to be. I mean, how can you be a successful president in crisis and not have a hard, you know, hard man's side? You can't just be a sweet, genial person. You need that sweetness. I don't mean to downplay that too much, and I think it was genuine. I think he really was sweet, but there was a tough man in there.
Well, there was a general in there. There was a man who was a general who was in the military field, a genius.
He was. I mean, he had the great good fortune of having liberated Europe and commanded the largest invasion ever and the largest army ever before he became president. This will give you a certain amount of confidence. I mean, you know, I'm always asked to compare him to Romney and Obama, and it's a little bit unfair because they didn't command D-Day, you know.
Right.
Ike had a unique training. In fact, on his first night as president, he kept a diary, and he wrote, well, big problems and big challenges, but, you know, doesn't feel all that new. In a way, I've been doing this for a long time. Compare that to Harry Truman, who the first time he walked into the Oval Office visibly recoiled at the sight of the desk that he was going to have to occupy. You know, Ike was accustomed to enormous responsibility, not just the decision to invade France, you know, that famous decision at D-Day, but Eisenhower had routinely sent thousands of men to their deaths. So he was practiced and trained for great responsibility, and a good thing it was, because he was taking over the presidency at a time when the United States and the Soviet Union were reaching, and I love this phrase because it's so benign but so creepy, nuclear plenty.
Yeah.
Nuclear plenty means enough nuclear bombs to destroy the world. That's the world that Eisenhower was taking over, as it were. America, in a way, kind of was the most powerful country in the world in 1953, and I suppose it still is, but then, you know, really was. And it's just an awesome responsibility with a Soviet Union and global communism, not monolithic, but out there, that was bent on historical domination. You know, really, they weren't, the Soviets' rhetoric was pretty scary. Khrushchev, Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet premier, saying, "We will bury you." Now, maybe he was being metaphorical, but you know, you hear those words. He's always bragging about all these rockets that the Soviets were cranking out like sausages. I mean, it was a scary time, and that's what Ike had to deal with.
What makes this book so interesting to me is that we realize how important this issue of avoiding nuclear war was to Eisenhower and how it consumed him. And as the title suggests, Ike's Bluff, to him, at how aware was he and how conscious of the fact of the gamble?
Well, he was. He, it's a little bit hard to know because part of the gamble, and one thing that intrigued me, and one reason why I wrote the book, was that Ike never told anyone under what circumstances he would use those weapons. Why? Because the minute he starts talking about it to anybody, you know, Washington leaks,
right,
he loses his credibility. The only way the deterrence works, and the only way the bluff works, is by keeping his own counsel, by telling no one under what circumstances he would use these terrible weapons. So nobody ever knew. I got into this because I was talking to somebody who knew Ike's great aide, General Goodpaster, and if anybody would know what Ike was really thinking, it was Andy Goodpaster. And Andy Goodpaster shook his head saying that he didn't know. He didn't think that Ike would ever use nuclear weapons, but he didn't know because Ike never told him. So that intrigued me and drew me into this story. That's an awful responsibility to have, but that was the bluff, and to be credible, he could tell no one. The Soviets believed him because, back to what we were talking about earlier, this was a pretty powerful warrior, and he'd sent an awful lot of men to their deaths, so they took Ike's bluffing seriously, and they backed down. In effect, he's calling the Soviets' bluff. He knows the Soviets are not as strong as they pretend to be, and he knows that they're not going to use nuclear weapons, or at least he's taking that gamble.
What is interesting is that, and I think it's impossible not to do this, but in reading the book, you realize how insulated he is, how the personal responsibility he takes for this, avoiding partisanship, working with all sides, and you compare this to modern-day politics, especially now during this campaign season where everybody's getting up on the stump and screaming about how great they are and what they've done, and that was a game he didn't play.
Yeah, I mean, it's impossible not to compare it, and I got to say, it makes you nostalgic for Ike in the 1950s. Now, this is a little unfair. I mean, we live in a different era. There was no internet in the 1950s. There weren't TV talk shows. You know, I mean, it's a different age. Right?
Common sense, though.
But the larger point, yes, and that is the larger point, that Eisenhower had a kind of confidence that we miss. He had the kind of confidence that made him humble. What do I mean by that? I mean, we see a lot of arrogant people who I think are kind of blustering and really insecure. I mean, I know when I'm arrogant, it's usually because I'm afraid of something. Eisenhower had a kind of quiet confidence that allowed him to be humble, to let others take credit, to not blab too much. You know, he was even willing to play dumb. There's this scene in my book that always entertained me, at least, that before a press conference, his aides are saying to him, "Oh, you have to be careful about this, and what if they ask you that?" And Eisenhower says, "Oh, don't worry, I'll just confuse them."
Hmm.
Now, can you imagine a modern president intentionally playing dumb like that? It just wouldn't happen. You had to have an awful lot of confidence to pretend that you were not as smart as you actually were. But Eisenhower had that kind of confidence, and it worked. Now, it sort of was to his detriment in history, because people, you know, in later years, so, well, he was just this kind of, you know, genial, dopey golf player. Well, he wasn't, but he was willing to be underestimated. It's a useful thing in life to be willing to be underestimated, and Eisenhower was, and it made him more effective.
In making him more effective, he was also really coming to terms with his own temper. and realizing what it was that could screw it up.
Yeah, I mean that's a big point. You didn't know about this in the 1950s. The guy was a Vesuvius. I mean, when he blew, he could really blow. Eisenhower's mother was a fundamentalist Christian, and she would quote scripture at him. And she had, I'm paraphrasing here, she would say to him, "He who conquereth his own soul is greater than he who conquers a city." And Eisenhower would trot this line out to show how his mother had taught him to hold his temper. And one of his aides once said, "What a poor job she had done." Because Eisenhower did have a temper, and it did blow up. It blew up behind the scenes. He didn't do it in public, but his own aides felt the wrath of Ike. Ike was human. I mean, one of the things I try to do in this story is I'm obviously a great admirer of Eisenhower, and it's a book that reveres him, but he's human, and he had a temper, and he lost it, and he was kind of scary to be around. He worried. I mean, all of this stuff that I admire him for, that he could hold great responsibility, it took its toll. He couldn't sleep. He got hooked on sleeping pills at the end of his life. You know, he went through this grinding. He smoked 4 packs of cigarettes a day as a general. He did quit those, but, you know, all this stress takes its toll. He had a major coronary in 1955. I mean, today, I'm not sure he could have taken a second term after that. He had a stroke in 1957. He was operated on for a stomach ailment in June of 1957. I mean, he had a lot of physical issues which he dealt with, which he more or less kept from the public, although the public knew after his heart attack, of course. He shouldered these terrible burdens, but at a cost. I had this doctor's diary. The doctor kept a daily diary. And so you can read it. It's fascinating. You can see what his moods were and what pills they were giving him, and it helped me humanize him.
Here is the man that you point out in the book was the first person in history to have the power to destroy the world. And the fact that we look back on that time as a 30-second duck and cover PSA is really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, think about it. This is a power that no human being in history had ever had before. The bombs we dropped in World War II were big bombs, but the H-bomb, which the first one was tested, I think, the day after Ike's election in 1952, is 500 times more powerful than the atom bombs dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And, of course, the numbers were just going up from there. And so Eisenhower has to grapple with this kind of existential reality. I mean, they had to consider things like, should we hit the Soviet Union first? Should we do a preemptive strike to take out the Soviet Union before they can come at us? I mean, that's a pretty grim little conversation right there. But they had to have it really on moral grounds. You know, should we kill them before they can kill us? Now, Ike obviously decided not to do that, but there's private correspondence where he's thinking about it. And even after he had decided against it, Curtis LeMay and the Strategic Air Command, they wanted to do it. You know, Sunday punch, let's go after them before we can get those sons of bitches, before they can get us. So there were pressures in Ike's own military to do this kind of thing. And in any case, there's this feeling of being at a sword's point, because we didn't know that much about the Soviet Union. They made a lot of threatening noises at us. They threatened us in Berlin. They threatened us in Europe. Their surrogates threatened us all over the world. You know, at what point is push going to come to shove here? And Eisenhower was determined to avoid that moment.
I think that avoidance is such an interesting thing to read, and you write about beautifully in the book, is that contradiction of, you have this general and this person who was a supreme commander of the Allied forces in Europe during World War II, and yet having seen those horrors of war and realizing that it is indeed hell, learns from that and tries to avoid it and becomes, in many ways, a pacifist.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of counterintuitive, but he had seen war. I mean, I have this scene at the end of World War II. He goes to the concentration camps. And you can imagine what that's like. He's with General Patton, you know, famous Patton, who's this tough guy. Patton vomits. because he's so appalled by what he's seeing. Eisenhower writes that Eisenhower orders the mayor of the village where the concentration camp is to bring the village out to clean it up, clean up the dead bodies. The next day, he finds out that the mayor of this German village has hung himself. And Eisenhower's response is interesting. He was weirdly, this is going to sound wrong, but encouraged by it, that there at least was some conscience left, that terrible to celebrate somebody's suicide, but at least the Germans were guilty enough and appalled and sick enough so that this guy took his own life. This is the kind of moral horror that Eisenhower had to deal with as a commander, and it prepared him, it deepened his spirituality, if you will, the depth of his character when he's thinking about war. He had seen the aftermath of World War II, hideous in the extreme, flying over the Ukraine where nothing's standing because German and Russian armies had just marched over it. Literally, nothing is standing. No buildings are standing. So Eisenhower knew war, and he just didn't want to get us into one.
When you think about all of this in political terms, and you write about this at the toward the end of the book, about his thoughts on Nixon and Kennedy, and then when you think of those individuals and those stories, I don't know, does that change the context at all?
Well, one thing, I was always a Kennedy fan. I wrote a book about Bobby Kennedy, and I still think John F. Kennedy was a good president. But it's clear to me that Kennedy was, as Eisenhower used to say, a whippersnapper. And one of the unfortunate things is that Kennedy, like a lot of politicians, believed that you could have limited wars, partial wars. I mean, politicians believe in compromise, half measures. And Kennedy's belief in this and Lyndon Johnson's belief in this and the so-called doctrine of flexible response led to what? To Vietnam. Eisenhower was an all-or-nothing guy. If he was going in all the way or not at all, he kept us out of Vietnam. And I wish that Kennedy and Johnson had Eisenhower's maturity of judgment about this kind of thing. They were consulting with Ike, and Ike was supportive generally because you stand by the commander-in-chief, but he was basically saying to him, hey, don't do this unless you mean to really do it. He wanted to, if you're going to go into Vietnam, declare war and go all the way. Don't do it halfway measures. But, of course, Johnson and Kennedy couldn't really hear that message, and I think our country paid a price for that.
You have Ike quoted in the book as saying, I'll do almost anything to avoid turning over my seat and the country to Kennedy. And yet, he and Nixon were not naturally close, and their relationship was formal at best.
Yeah. I mean, I was having lunch with John Eisenhower the other day, and he reminded me, he told me that his father, President Eisenhower, had to give himself an order to like Nixon. Because Nixon was an admirable guy in many ways, but not that easy to like.
Yeah.
And you can feel this tension between them all through the presidency. And Ike did campaign for Nixon, wanted Nixon to win, but he hurt Nixon when at a press conference somebody asked Ike, well, give us an example of something that Nixon, Vice President Nixon, has done that really made a difference. And Ike said, well, if you give me a week, I'll think of something. Mm. Woo! I mean, actually uncharacteristic of Ike, who was pretty careful about choosing his words, but it sort of slipped out for a variety of reasons. And Nixon was stung by that, and Ike tried to make it up to him, but boy, that remark did some damage.
How ultimately do you think that, as I mentioned, you know, at the beginning of this interview, that my interest in this man has certainly increased, and I think a lot of people have, as we turn in history. Do you think his legacy is changing subtly?
Yes, I mean, there's definitely more interest. My book is I think the third book this year published on Ike, and you know, the scholars have known about this more aggressive, powerful Ike for quite a while, but the public is only slowly catching up to it. I think it's a good thing. I mean, it's a good thing for my book sales.
Yes,
but it is. I think it's a redressing of history that needs to happen, and because the values that Ike stood for, this quiet confidence and this ability to accept responsibility, these are valuable things to think about today in our celebrity culture, where, you know, I teach school here at Princeton, and one of the kids are wonderful, but, you know, you kind of wonder, sometimes they're a little too quick to pass responsibility off to somebody else, and they could maybe use a little dose of Ike. They've been over-parented, you could argue, spoiled a little bit, you could say. Ike had this willingness to take on personal responsibility that was admirable, and it was a quality that I think that we could use some more of today. So I think he's an example to all of us about a way to carry yourself and comport yourself, sort of a wordy like comportment, that lives on, and I think it's basic to the American character, but be great if we saw some more of.
And you talk about American character, but here was a guy who gave 50 years of his life to public service.
Yeah, I mean, this was his whole life to serve his country. Interestingly, at the end, he didn't want to be a Mr. President. He reverted to being a general, five-star general, which puzzled Kennedy. He said, what's that about? Well, I think it's partly because Eisenhower wanted to keep his valet, Sergeant Money, which he could only do as a general. But I think it was because his life was in the Army, and he was a general, you know. That was his first love. But, yes, he gave his entire life to public service. Ultimately, it killed him, you know. The heart attack did get to him. It certainly stressed him out and strained him. But this is he was a life of service. He knew no other life, and it was a noble life.
The book is fascinating and so wonderfully written. It's Ike's Bluff, President Eisenhower's Secret Battle to Save the World. It is published by Little Brown, and it's been a delight to talk to Evan Thomas this morning about it. Evan, thank you very much for being with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.